Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Human societies were organized in some pretty brutal, unappealing ways for a long, long time. With late 20th century democracy and capitalism, a lot of Americans thought we had it all figured out, the way. But the opening years of the 21st century have not been flattering to the Western way. There are big, basic questions being raised. This hour on Point, are Western-style democracy and capitalism up to the challenges of the 21st century? You can join the conversation. What's happened to our winning formula? Does the American way still look like a global beacon? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got two guests this hour who've been struggling with these big questions in the pages of Foreign Affairs magazine. Joining us from New York is Gideon Rose, editor of Foreign Affairs. His piece in the big 90th anniversary issue, out now, is Making Modernity Work, the Reconciliation of Capitalism and Democracy. He's author of How Wars End, just out in paperback. Gideon Rose, welcome to On Point. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Charles Kupchan, professor of international affairs at Georgetown University, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His essay in the big foreign affairs issue is The Democratic Malaise, Globalization and the Threat to the West. It's adapted from his upcoming book, No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. Charles Kupchan, welcome back to you as well.
Happy to join you, Tom.
I want Gideon Rose to ask you to take us through a little bit of history, but before we turn to that, Charles Kupchan, the seriousness of the threat to what a lot of Americans thought not many years ago, Francis Fukuyama, you know, talked about the end of history and people all interpreted that in their own way, but we thought we'd figured it out. And now you're writing, you know, the model that we were so pleased with as the 20th century ended is showing real signs of trouble. How serious, Charles?
I think it's very serious. It's too soon to tell whether we're going through a very rough patch or whether we're actually hitting an inflection point in history in which the sense that a Western version of modernity would prevail. But if we go back 20 years when Frank Fukuyama wrote his piece about the end of history, we really did think that there was one road, that the liberal democratic industrial capitalist model would prevail, and it was only a question of when and no longer if. But now we look around at the world and we see a state capitalism brand of industry in China. We see political Islam on the rise in the Middle East. And I think most surprisingly, we see the industrialized West, the countries at the leading edge of history, the U.S., Europe, Japan, all stumbling with declining incomes for their middle classes, with rising rates of inequality, and with political systems that have really seized up for now. And so I think the question is this a passing moment, or is something deeper going on here?
And you're advising us not to be too confident that it's a passing moment. You write these trends are not temporary byproducts of the business cycle. There's something bigger.
Yeah, I think that's partly what might divide Gideon and myself. I think Gideon would say this is a rainy day or a very stormy day, and I think that the forces that are causing the decline of the Western model, or at least a setback for the Western model, run deep. They have to do with globalization, which has caused jobs to leave the United States, which has caused jobs to leave Europe and Japan. And that's why middle-class incomes are stagnant and in some cases declining. It's why inequality is increasing. The United States is now the most unequal country in the industrialized world. Almost one-third of Americans are either poor or just above the poverty line. Those are really quite staggering observations, and I think it raises questions about whether we really do need to do just not some temporary tinkering, but some real revisions in both our economy and in the way that liberal democracy functions.
A model in trouble, at least at the moment. Gideon Rose, this is quite an issue of Foreign Affairs you put out. It's the 90th anniversary, and it's got really interesting essays from across that whole span of time. You give us the favor of a kind of thumbnail history in here of the broad stroke evolution of sort of political economy, political thought over the last couple hundred years. And I wish you'd just do that for us right here, Gideon, to bring us up. You take it to the point that says, you know what, in the 20th century, we did figure it out, how a mixed economy and democracy could work together and prosper. But I wish you'd take us sort of starting back. You start in at the pre-modern era, governed by this dense web of interlocking relationships inherited from the past and sanctified by religion, you write, Gideon. Take us through that evolutionary arc.
Sure. You know, thanks, Tom. One of the great fun things about being an editor is you basically get to throw a party in your pages and invite who you want.
Yeah.
And so we put together a lot of not just great historical stuff from the pages of Foreign Affairs, but I had Frank Fukuyama, who has another piece in this package, and Charlie write. I actually am less gloomy than Charlie and Frank are, both of whom see the model, as Charlie just said, in more trouble than I do. And the reason I'm a little bit less leery of the future than they are is because, especially just having put together the historical package, it strikes me that the first thing that's necessary is to understand that model that we thought was the end of history and realize just what it means, and then we can revive it in the 21st century. Basically, the story starts before capitalism. It starts in what used to be called the old regime. And you had traditional society. And essentially, life there was extremely constricted. Everybody had roles. Everybody had traditions and relationships. There was not much mobility. There was not much personal freedom. There was not much social or economic dynamism. Capitalism comes along, and it erodes all this stuff. It opens up life. Markets spread. And the result of that is personal freedom, economic dynamism, economic growth, and the erosion of the old way of life. But it also means a loss of community, a rise in ennui and angst. People have more opportunities and more freedom, but they have fewer bulwarks against the vicissitudes of life. And they're adrift psychologically, personally, communally.
And people and so societies responded to that drift, not to mention to the volatility and harshness of the capitalism.
Exactly. So you get, there was a great economic sociologist named Carl Polanyi who talked about the double movement of capitalism. What happens in modern society is markets go forward because they bring all these wonderful things and all this wonderful dynamism. But then society reacts against the bad things that come with that, the disruption, the turmoil, the joblessness, the lack of hope, and so forth. And so you have this big fight for how do you make democracy and capitalism compatible in the modern world. And what happens is in the early part of the 20th century, in the interwar years, you have a big struggle with communism and fascism, each emerging and providing alternatives because liberalism in its old-fashioned classical version, laissez-faire, government doesn't do anything, almost you might say a Ron Paul type view of the world. What that produces is essentially an economy and society that's very dynamic, but it's very, very difficult to live in. You have mass unemployment if things go badly. You have great inequalities. You have people who are basically thrown on the ash heap of history personally.
So you have the Soviets and the Nazis and others trying to figure out a different way, ways that ended up rejected and failed. But these were reactions to realities.
They were reactions to the problems of capitalist modernity. They had their own problems, but so did liberalism. And so what happens after the Great Depression or in the wake of the Great Depression is that liberalism revives itself and realizes that you have to give up laissez-faire and create some kind of social protection against the ravages of capitalism in order to make it democratically acceptable to a large bunch of people. And so what happens is you get this new version of capitalism, the post-war order, that emerges in the 40s and 50s, in which you have liberal democracy as your political system, open societies as your society, and a kind of mixed economy, capitalist entrepreneurship and capitalist dynamism as the driving force, but regulations keeping that in check, a welfare state helping to provide for the old and the poor and the infirm, and essentially spreading the wealth, in that contemporary phrase, enough to make everybody feel that they benefit from this. And this was the model. The problem is that right now we're in a bad spot for a whole variety of reasons, both the international ones that Charlie focuses on his piece, as well as the political dysfunction and stagnation of the recent years politically and so forth.
But the real challenge is getting back to
A capitalism that produces growth and spreads the benefits of that around the entire society. That's what the 99% Occupy Wall Street types wanted, I think, the smartest of them. And it's something that we actually all can agree with. We just have to figure out how to get there.
On the other hand, and we'll come to Charles Kupchan on this, but you've got Ross Douthat writing over the weekend saying that post-war order you were talking about was expensive and we could only have it because that was a time when Asia was kind of asleep economically, when you had Europe still destroyed after World War II. You had the socialist countries that weren't really competing with us. He said, we can't afford that now, Gideon.
Well, this is a great issue, and this is the challenge. In some ways, Charlie feels the same way about that, I think, and Frank is very gloomy. I'm less gloomy. If you look at our current political system and our current governmental structure, there are all sorts of gross inefficiencies. There have been whole sectors of society and the economy and government that have been captured by special interests. If you manage to actually get a bunch of relatively decent technocratic trade-offs, take a look at Simpson-Bowles. You put that in place, even though the right doesn't want taxation and the left doesn't want entitlement reform, if you were to put together some kind of sensible package that actually did both of those together, I think you could get a lot of things back on track. The problem is we have a system that's open to all sorts of checks and balances, and the government can't do what it needs to do to revive and reform itself. That's our chief problem right now.
Charles Kupchan, just a half a minute before the break, but Gideon Rose essentially says, look, we've got the formula. We figured it out after a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in the 20th century, and let's just be smart about applying it now.
Well, I agree with Gideon that history has converged, that the big ideological debates of the past, monarchy versus Nazism versus fascism versus communism, that stuff is gone. We're all capitalists now. And in that sense, the divergence, the wave of change that we've seen is quite striking. But I do think that we're hitting a period of history in which we're seeing more diversity, the need for more pluralism, more roads, not fewer roads. And then in the second point, can we fix it? What really worries me is that we, not that we don't know what to do, but that we may not be able to do it because our political systems are so seized up, are so balkanized that even if we know what to do, we can't get the political momentum to implement those ideas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about democracy and capitalism, how they fit together now and whether they win in a globalized economy. Gideon Rose is with us. He's editor of Foreign Affairs. They're out with their big 90th anniversary issue with essays from across those entire nine decades that remind us of how people have struggled with these issues, of how to structure a successful, equitable, dynamic society. He says, we've pretty much figured it out. We figured it out in the 20th century. Mixed economy, that is, private enterprise plus government oversight and regulation. Get that formula right. Mix it with democracy. You're on your way. Charles Kupchan is with us as well. He writes in the same issue. He says he's not so sure that that's going to pull together up against the globalized challenges that the system and our country now face. Charles Kupchan, come back to the Gideon position again, if you would. Because, you know, we want to believe it, that we figured it out. It worked great. The U.S. had great growth and, you know, lots of participation, which we expanded during the Civil Rights Movement. If we get back on that track, we'll be all right in this century. You're not so sure why.
Well, I think that the basic formula that enabled the West to prevail was the rise of the middle class and the rise of a working class that was gainfully employed, that had expectations for the future that were better than the past. And that led to a sense of hopefulness. It legitimated democratic governments, and it meant that liberal democracies had wind in their sails. And what I think is happening now is that basic social bargain is now up for grabs. And Americans and Europeans and Japanese are wondering whether the system works for them or whether they now live in societies that basically favor the advantaged few. You now have in this country a situation in which the 1% highest earners take away about 25%+ of the American income. And so the question is, okay, if this is the problem, what are we going to do about it? And I agree with Gideon that the answers are out there. But what I worry about is whether we can get to yes, whether we can implement them. And I see three big obstacles. One is that globalization has undermined the ability of liberal democracies to act in the way they used to. They push a button and nothing happens. And that's because...
What kind of button, Charles? What do you mean by that?
Lots of different policy levers. For example, we had a $787 billion stimulus package in this country. Did it revive the economy? No.
No.
We have fluctuations in interest rates in Europe. We have the Japanese trying one stimulus package after another. Does it work? No. Why? Because we are now so tethered to other countries and so sensitive to the decisions of Standard & Poor's, of Hyundai, of the Chinese government on the value of their currency, that we just don't have as much control as we used to. Second problem is that we got many more cooks in the kitchen. We used to run the world through the G7, which was basically liberal, democratic, industrialized countries. They'd meet together, or NATO would meet together, and we'd decide what we wanted to do, and we'd go out and do it. Well, guess what? We now have the G20. Most of the countries in the G20 are not Western. Many of them are not democratic, and it's very hard to get consensus. And then the third problem is that democracies are very good when people are generally happy and content. But they are not very good when people are forlorn or discontent or feeling disadvantaged. And I think right now in the United States, we are facing a level of polarization that is like nothing we have ever seen in this era. Perhaps we saw it in the 19th century, but certainly not since World War II. And that's why it's so difficult for American officials to get the job done. And I think it speaks volumes, Tom, that Obama is now campaigning on an agenda of dealing with income inequality, of trying to speak to the middle class and the working class. And even the Republicans are doing the same. Look what people were saying to Romney last night. They were going after him for being too good a businessman, for taking companies and making them more profitable but losing jobs. I think it's clear what is bothering Americans, and finally politicians are speaking to those issues.
Gideon Rose, what do you make of the way that our parties, the representatives of this democracy that we were so proud of in the 20th century, the way they're handling the challenge we're up against now? I mean, you write, you say, the central question of modernity has been how to reconcile capitalism and mass democracy. And since the post-war order came up with a good answer, it's managed to weather all subsequent challenges. Why are things so difficult now? I mean, you describe very old-fashioned capitalism as Ron Paul style. Ron Paul is very popular again in the polls in the GOP primary.
Well, he's popular with a small portion of the GOP electorate. And, you know, there's always been people on somewhat of the political extremes. I agree with Charlie about the problems that he described and about the challenges that are out there. And I certainly don't think that the Western model is working particularly well right now, or that there isn't the discontent that he and others are seeing. But, you know, Churchill once said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. And I think that our problems are terrible except for the problems that all the other periods of history had. When you think of the challenges that politically and economically we have faced in the past, they were of a much greater order. And they were questions of what is the right way to organize society, economy, politics, and so forth. Now, I agree with Charlie. The question is, how do you do what we actually realize is the right thing to do? And the problem exactly is one of political dysfunction. And I think honesty is part of the answer. It's the beginning of an answer. So if you look at this whole debate over Romney's role at Bain and that just most recently came up in South Carolina, I think it's absolutely fascinating because it gets right to the heart of the questions we're talking about in this issue, which is the Republican Party has this fictional idea that capitalism is always good in every way, shape, or form, and that's the winning formula. And anybody who wants to do anything regarding constricting markets of any kind is some kind of socialist engaged in class warfare and so forth, and hence their ridiculous attacks on Obama for this. But the reality is that capitalism, while wonderful in the aggregate and wonderful in the long term, tends to be volatile and unequal and very divisive in the short term and for different parts of society. And when you put a spotlight on the actions of capitalism, you realize most people in a democracy don't want pure capitalism. That's what actually failed in the Great Depression. That's why you got the New Deal. That's why you got the welfare state. That's why you got Social Security. That's why you got a more active government regulation. And so the real question is not, should we regulate the economy? Should we have a welfare state? Voters repeatedly and continually, whenever they have been given a choice, have basically said, yes, we want all those things. The question is, can you do it efficiently? Can you do it without killing the goose that gives the golden eggs of capitalism and markets? Can you find some way to do it at a good, reasonable cost? That's the kind of debate. And if we can actually say, you know what? Capitalism is neither good by itself nor bad by itself, but has a mixed bag of good and bad things. What are the kinds of regulations, the kinds of interventions, the kinds of government programs that can help achieve the benefits of capitalism while cushioning large amounts of society from its inevitable downside.
That's
the real challenge.
Yeah, I must say, despite the criticisms of Bain Capital, I haven't really heard that debate in the primary season so far. Gideon Rose, Charles Kupchan, standby. Let's bring our callers in. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As I'm listening to your panel, the gentleman just said something about the Bain Capital. The reason that's going on, Gingrich was mad because Romney's group, they were putting out ads he thought were inaccurate. And so Gingrich is doing the same thing. But as far as capitalism goes, capitalism has brought greater wealth, more prosperity, more freedom than anything in the history of the world. Now, I guess we could go back to Joseph Stalin, you know, his form of government, or just plain Marxism. I would have more respect for people if they said, well, we want a form of Marxism. They dance around it. The president, with his invidious speeches, it is class warfare.
But Jerry, Jerry, I got your perspective, but let me ask you.
Please, Tom.
No, I think we've got the point. Let me ask you this. Gideon Rose is not saying let's go to Marxism or Stalinism. He's saying let's go to Americanism of the mid-20th century when we did pretty darn well in this country. Is that bad to you?
No, it's not bad, but let's look back at that period of time. Look at the people. Whitaker Chambers, in his book Witness, pointed out the people in the New Deal. I mean, Nathan Whitty, head of the National Labor Relations Board, was a member of the Harold Ware Group, was a communist spy organization.
But are you calling the mid-20th century America that a whole lot of people listening right now grew up in a communist conspiracy?
No, I'm not. It's not a conspiracy, Tom. I mean, these are congressional records.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, I'm not talking about it at the edges there, but right in the middle of this society. Let's pick it up on its merits. Gideon? Jerry says, look, what you describe as the American way, he might see as an aberration.
Well, but see, you know, here you have that wonderful sign at one of the Tea Party rallies, keep your government hands off my Medicare. There was there's a gap between the reality of the government programs that exist today and the way we talk about them. There's a wonderful academic named Suzanne Mettler who talks about the submerged state. And there's so many, for example, government benefits that go to homeowners with mortgage deductions or things like that, in which the government provides benefits for society. But because they're not done in very direct cash transfer ways, we don't think of them as government interventions. And so whenever there's some kind of specific immediate government intervention, we get all upset at socialism, extensive government, and so forth. In reality, what we need is an honest debate about what role government should play to benefit whom, in what ways, and what are the costs of doing that. Unfortunately, our politicians are a bunch of children, and they think we're a bunch of children, and they play exaggerated, caricatured stereotypes for our benefit. And so you get a lot of heat, but no light on these things.
Charles, Gideon says go back to the mid-20th century. An awful lot of people, Jerry in Tennessee, you hear the way he pushes against that. And despite the fact that Romney's taken some criticism on Bain Capital, I mean, the main thrust of Republican politics for a long time has hardly been to go back to that. It's been, much as our caller has just done, to describe that as an aberration, not the American way.
Well, listen, I think Jerry's right that capitalism has produced more benefits for more people than any other system. Capitalism and economic growth is highly correlated with liberal politics and democracy. So I don't think anyone on this show or most people in America are questioning capitalism. But what I think people are questioning, and Gideon said this directly several times already, is the nature of capitalism, the brand of capitalism. I think one thing we've learned from the last couple of decades is when markets are left to their own devices without sufficient regulation, without sufficient oversight, without care to make sure that the rewards are distributed across society, it tends to spin out of control. It tends to advantage a small few at the cost of the broader society. And Gideon mentioned earlier Carl Polanyi, the book, The Great Transformation. And that's a very sobering book. People should read it if they want some insight into globalization, because basically what he argued is that when the great democracies of the early part of the 20th century were left open, unfettered to the globalized world, they got slapped around. They got whipsawed, and they eventually pushed back. They said, we're angry, and we're not going to take this anymore. And that's when you got the dark 1930s. That's when you got fascism. And Polanyi is in some ways saying, be careful. Yes, let's have capitalist economies, but let's watch them carefully and make sure that we put in the necessary breaks so that they work.
But Gideon, here's Barack Obama, President Obama, and you know how scathingly he's been attacked for doing things that were part of that mid-20th century American formula for regulation, for intervention sometimes in the economy. He's been, you know, Mitt Romney has called him, you know, European style. The socialist is the word that gets thrown around.
You know, it's actually funny because, of course, there are parts of Europe, particularly Northern Europe, which are in some ways the most socialist. They're the ones who are authentically social democratic. And yet they're also ones who are doing very well by their populations, by their economies and so forth. And so it's not at all true that all European socialism or social democracy is a giant sump of human despair and economic stagnation. In fact, if you had to pick a model around the world outside U.S. politics that is considered very successful these days and very attractive, I think the Scandinavian model, which has essentially a lot of government intervention in the economy, but intervention designed to create a nice, healthy, equal society in which capitalist activity can proceed. A lot of people would take that in a second.
But do you see Obama referencing that, or is he referencing, as you would have it, 20th century American policy, mixed economy, high growth?
Oh, I think that Obama would be an idiot to say that I really want to take America towards Scandinavia, even if that's what he actually thinks, precisely because of the caricatures that prevail in American politics. He's already a Kenyan anti-colonialist in some people's eyes. If he were to be a black social democrat, that would also be even worse. But, you know, the reality is that we have this real set of challenges, but we have a political debate and a political culture that operates on an entirely different level, and so you can't honestly discuss things. The fact is about government taking over healthcare. Well, the real problem is not so much government taking over healthcare, but what is the alternative to that? Do you want the insurance companies and various kinds of markets taking over different parts of that? Who will, you know, how will that work? The fact is that Obama is trying, I think, in a very tentative and not particularly articulate way to restructure the economy along some of the lines that I personally think are perfectly fine. But for a variety of reasons, he's not getting the political traction in being able to do that well.
Steve in Norfolk, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks. Thanks, Tom. A great show. I have to qualify what I'm going to say by pointing out that I spent most of my career, 35-plus years, working in a large global business and helped set up and globalize a corporation a number of years ago, there isn't free markets. If we take free markets to the extreme, I think we have to just accept that corporations are set up to maximize return to shareholders. And if you take that to its extreme, corporations, a competition is not beneficial to corporations. Eventually, they would end up buying their competitors, right, in order to maximize their profits. And so we would land up with monopolies. And I want to see whether your guests agree with that. And secondly, in terms of jobs going overseas, again, in an attempt to maximize returns, you use your lowest cost workers. But do they ever come back?
These are structural issues. Charles Kupchan, I mean, on the one hand, Steve worked for a global corporation for 35 years. He says, if you don't watch out, they will move toward monopoly standing if they can achieve it. But what about the structural issue of jobs just not coming back to make this democracy a happier, better functioning place, Charles?
Well, I agree with what Steve just said, and I think that, you know, you go to a corporation, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to get a good business model, increase their revenue, increase shareholder value. And so the question is, well, where does social equity come in? Where does social responsibility come in? And the answer is, well, hopefully you get CEOs or boards that worry about that. But mainly that is going to come from governments, from international organizations, from bodies that are charged precisely with making sure that capitalism functions. And I think what's happened over the last couple of decades is that globalization has shifted jobs away from the industrialized West. They are not coming back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about democracy and capitalism, no less, how they fit together now and whether they win in a globalized economy. Gideon Rose is with us, editor of Foreign Affairs, that with a big 90th anniversary edition that looks back over nearly a century of deep thinking about the way things work and perhaps how they ought to be working, might work now. Charles Kupchan joins us as well. He's got a big piece in the same issue called The Democratic Malaise, Globalization and the Threat to the West. He says, do not count on the Western model that has had such a heyday continuing to have that heyday. There are forces working against it. Get your house in order, he says. Gideon Rose, here's a listener who writes online, asks, how do we return to a mixed economy in time? Our democracy has been corrupted. Corporations are now persons. They stack the deck in their favor. The system's broken for the 99%. So how does the 99% overcome this corruption before it all falls apart? Gideon.
Well, this is a great challenge. And, you know, I agree with what Charlie was saying at the end of before the last break. Mm-hmm. Basically, the question of how to find jobs in an increasingly globalized world in which countries abroad are doing exactly what we wanted them to do, which is develop autonomously and liberalize their economies and their societies, but in the process can do a lot of things, thanks to technology, for us, and jobs, therefore, migrate to people who can do them cheaply and well and more easily than we can. The challenge of how you get essentially jobs back here or how you create new jobs here is the central challenge of our times, I think, in a globalized world. And the challenge of how you restructure the operations of government so that it benefits the society as a whole rather than a relatively privileged few is one of the chief domestic challenges. There's no question but that inequality has increased and that in the last generation and that one of the drivers of that has been a government that increasingly favors the wealthy and the privileged over the broad mass of society. How you get the political reform to do that, you basically get out there and vote and organize and create policies that that people want. And it'll be very hard to do that unless we have some kind of a political movement off the really stagnant divide that we have today in politics. I should mention, by the way, that if people are interested in this issue and in the article excerpts we have online, we have an ebook with the full text of all the articles in the issue that's available via our website, foreignaffairs.com, which it provides further reading, you might say, about these kinds of subjects.
A feast of food for thought there. Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Howard, thanks. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. With all the discussion of the word globalization being thrown around, I think we would do better if we return to the old term trade policy, which has a lot to do with America losing its manufacturing base, which is how we lose our middle class. For example, right now the Chinese charge 25% tariffs on U.S. manufactured goods coming in. We charge 2.5%. There's no way we can compete globally. This ties in with capitalism taking over our government and helping to elect the politicians who write those treaties.
Howard, let me take that to Charles Kupchan. I mean, Charles, you think a lot about state involvement in economies, and you hear Howard's complaint. He says we're not playing the game.
Well, Howard's right that there are disadvantages out there because of the practices of other countries. But I think the core of the problem is wages, right? If you can build a widget in China at half the cost of building a widget in the United States, you're probably going to build it in China. And you can slap on a tariff here and there, but it's not going to solve the problem. In fact, it may be worse by creating an echo effect of retaliatory tariffs. So I think what you need to do is basically ask the question that Gideon was asking, which is how can we restructure our economy to be competitive, to play to our competitive advantages in this globalized world? And I think rather than going the protectionist route, we need to think hard about long-range strategic planning. We need a national infrastructure bank. We need education so that our populace is ready for jobs that are perhaps up the food chain from basic manufacturing. And all of this requires political solvency. And I think the right now we're in a bit of a catch-22 where you have the people with the political power being those who want to preserve the current system because of the campaign finance structure, because of the ability through of those special interests to capture the system. And therefore, we need some kind of centrist political movement to overcome the special interest impediments to reform, because I think it's only through that kind of broad-based political momentum that we can restructure the political system and then do the hard work of fixing the economic system.
Charles, you know, I'm reading that, but what you're describing here is like waving a giant red flag in front of the GOP as it's expressing itself anyway. I mean, you say everything is on the line here for our system, and we're not going to win if we I read you saying if we do what they're suggesting. You say when up against state capitalism and the potent force of global markets, the Western democracies have little choice but to engage in strategic economic planning on an unprecedented scale. Then you say state-led investment in jobs, state-led investment in infrastructure, education, research. This is just the opposite of what we're hearing from all these debates with the GOP contenders on the stage, Charles. It's exactly the opposite.
Well, I agree with you, Tom, and I'm sure that a lot of GOP supporters would consider what I've written and said heresy. But it seems to me that in today's world, when we are up against a country like China that has five-year economic plans, that builds highways and fast rail infrastructure and sort of has a view of what to do, we better get ready to play hardball. We better get ready to compete. And I'm not saying that we should start looking like the Chinese. I'm not saying that I think that autocracy has advantages over liberal democracy. It does not. But I think we have to be realistic in facing what kinds of changes politically and economically we need to make to compete. And a lot of those changes, at least from my perspective, Obama is better at understanding and pushing forward than his competitors.
Though, you know, he's hit such a headwind or an inability to articulate what needs to be done that it's not really happening. Maria in Iowa City, Iowa. Maria, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Great show. I love your guest. I want to read everything he's ever written. When he mentioned Obama, I thought of my stance in 2008. I gave Obama money. I switched to Hillary when she picked a fight with Senator John McCain on the floor of the Senate over 9/11 hero support for their medicine and medical care. I gave money to her. I gave a lot of money to her, and I saw the way the Democratic Party treated her, and I got very angry. I mean, I know a part of it is her fault, but we're mad as hell. We are mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to take it from the Democrats, and we're not going to take it from the Republicans either.
Where's the answer here? Where do you see us headed, Maria?
I think we need to have a whipsaw dialectic like what's happening in Wisconsin right now. We've got to have a governor or a president so bad, so antipathetic to working people, that there's got to be a reaction. I think things may have to get worse before they get better, because there's no way we have a candidate currently who can get the job done. I think people are dumb enough and ignorant enough, and I'm so angry at them, that they don't understand what's happening to them, and they won't understand until it starts happening. And I think that's why I'm giving all my money to Wisconsin Democrats and none of it to the Democratic National Committee, which I will never support again, and none of it to just anonymous Democratic candidates, some of whom I may not like and some of whom may have betrayed or snubbed Hillary on the Senate floor.
Hey, Maria, let's pick it up right there. Gideon Rose, Maria is so disenchanted, she thinks things have to get worse so they can get better. But we're in a competition here. Can we afford that way, Gideon?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the most interesting sets of articles in the issue are articles that show what happens when a lot of people start feeling like that and when the government and the society starts to lose the backing of large sectors of the population, and they get frustrated and angry and they search for alternatives. And it's a very, very dangerous proposition. It may be the catalyst to have reform emerge, but it's also something that could get very ugly and very bad very quickly. Just to lest those think that everything Charlie was saying was on the left and that this is all a pure sort of pro-Democrat program, I think everything he said was true, and you could throw in various kinds of entitlement reform as well as a necessary part of the project. And you could say that some of the sacred cows and protected interests that the existing system has let get fat at the expense of the society at large are ones that the existing Democratic Party protects as well. So I think that the kind
gained? I mean, what was so bad about the trade-off of the debt ceiling over the summer was that the Democrats basically said no entitlement reform, and the government and the Republicans said no taxes. And so neither of the major problems in the existing structure were dealt with. And it's going to take reform of both parties' establishments to get the kind of change that we actually need.
The major theme coming out of the GOP debates, as I hear it, is get government out of our economy, candidate after candidate. They're fighting over Bain Capital, but that's kind of an eddy on the side to this main theme. Where does that take us? If we have that policy in the White House and in Capitol Hill over the next 4 years or more, where do you see that going, Gideon?
Austerity would bring us an austerity in the midst of a very, very weak recovery from a very, very deep recession would be a disastrous and idiotic policy. You're seeing some of the problems with that in Europe. You saw it in the late 30s here in America as well. And how much of that is actually being pushed because various Republicans want the economy to do badly, therefore that it will hurt Obama, I'm not entirely sure. But certainly while long-term government debt and the size of government and reform of entitlement spending is a major problem for the future, in the short term, obviously, there's a greater need for stimulus, it seems to me, rather than cutting back.
Charles Kupchan, state-led investment in jobs, infrastructure, education, that just sounds like the opposite of what we're hearing there. And I don't really is anybody carrying that flag? Do we have to go beyond the state involvement in the mixed economy of the mid-20th century that Gideon Rose looks back to? Are you saying we're in some new phase that requires even more state involvement than that now?
Well, I agree with Gideon that you know, this is not a GOP versus Democratic issue in the sense that you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that the United States needs a balanced mix of cuts in spending and entitlement, increases in revenue, i.e. taxes, and targeted investment to get the country going. And I hope that you can get reasonable politicians that can come together on that basic formula. But yes, Tom, I would say that I am going beyond business as usual, that because we've gone through a phase of deindustrialization, because we've gone through a phase of stagnating wages for the vast majority of Americans, I don't think we can just tinker here and there. I really do think that we need to have a more directed program of investment in our economy, in our infrastructure, in our industry. It's, believe it or not, there is no agency in the United States government. And you know we have lots of agencies, mm-hmm. but not a single one that focuses on long-range economic planning. Why not establish some kind of executive legislative body that says this is where we are in 2012, this is where we want to be in 2022? How are we going to get there? Let's think about a rational allocation of resources.
Yes, but you know the free market answer to that is, you know, that's state planning of the old Soviet style. We don't do that. That's not America. In fact, our power comes from unleashing all the private energies in this country.
Well, I would say we've tried that. That's what we've been doing for the last couple of decades, and it hasn't worked so well. And I would say to politicians, listen carefully to what Maria said a couple of minutes ago mm-hmm. when she called in. She said, I'm madder than hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. Let's throw the bums out. Right? That's a pretty shocking statement from an American voter. And I think that politicians ought to listen carefully to what the average American is saying to them.
Gideon, you
know, I'm a little bit less in favor of massive government investment in economic long-term planning. Mm-hmm. The Charlie is not because in principle it wouldn't be a good idea, because I think that in practice it would be captured by the same interests we're talking about and therefore be yet another. I mean, the problem with many of these kinds of ideas is not that they couldn't work, but that in practice they wouldn't work because the same forces that capture government would capture them and it would just be somewhat inefficient. With regard to the long-term question of whether this is a fundamentally different situation for the world, I don't know. Charlie just quoted, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. That, of course, was a one from Network, a Patty Chayefsky script mm-hmm. back in the mid-70s. And we saw similar kinds of discussions about whether liberal democratic capitalism could survive, whether there were fundamental governance issues in the trilateral world that had history going against us. We managed to survive. I think we will as well. Again, the question is whether we muddle through or whether we do so sort of with some kind of direction and vitality. So I'm less worried that there's some other model out there that's going to topple us or replace us. but rather that we're not going to reach the full potential that we deserve and that we actually could reach if only we were able to get our political act together.
Well, you are the optimist. Charles Kupchan, you describe other models out there, other models that could move in. I mean, we began with Gideon describing a kind of arc of evolution of political systems. If we don't get our act together, where does this go? What are the stakes here, Charles?
Well, we're entering a very difficult and turbulent period in international history. And that's because the global distribution of power is rapidly changing. China will be the number one economy sometime by the end of the next decade. You've got Brazil, India, Indonesia, Turkey, the list goes on, coming on strong. And it's, I think, important for the West, number one, to get its act together to guide that transition, and number two, continue to be a beacon, continue to serve as a model for the rest of the world. So they want to be liberal, democratic, and capitalist. And I think to some extent, the allure has come off. Just one quick piece of data. In China, 85% of the population believes the country is heading in the right direction. What's the number here in the United States? Low 20s. That's worrying. And so I think the stakes in fixing this problem are high, precisely because we are moving into a period of history in which the West will no longer enjoy material dominance. That means we've got to make sure that our political system is agile and continues to serve as a beacon.
Boy, that seems like a tall order right now. Well, I guess we'll have to pull up our socks and really work on agile and serving as a beacon, not words we associate with that 20-something percent, we're on the right path data. Charles Kupchan, his forthcoming book is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn, out in March of this year. Thanks very much for being with us today, Charles.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Gideon Rose, author of How Wars End, out now in paperback, editor of Foreign Affairs and its big 90th anniversary edition, out right now. Lots to chew on in there. Gideon Rose, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.